Okay. Hi, I'm John Spector. I'm here at the Community 2.0 conference. We're talking now with Denise Howell and Mike Madison. Denise is a lawyer, a blogger, and a podcaster. And Mike is a professor at the University of Pittsburgh. And we're going to talk about a range of topics, first about communities in general, and then about a specific project to publish a book called We Are Smarter. So let's start with communities in general. Two sides of the coin. One is, what are the opportunities for big companies or any companies really to derive value from communities? And then a little bit later we'll talk about some of the challenges. Let's talk about the opportunities first. Go ahead, Denise, do you want to start?
Sure. I think one of the biggest opportunities, and it goes straight to the heart of the question that gets asked so frequently about why are communities even important to big companies? What is the bottom line and how do we measure ROI, or you know, where does it fall on the top line or the bottom line? How are these things quantifiable? And one of the things I think that communities can do like nothing else is turn your customers into evangelists for your product, your services, your brand. If you approach them properly and you come to a community, you either come to an external community or you create one yourself that encourages customers to, you know, in the question, we just at the luncheon here at the conference were considering Intuit, big money management software company, obviously, and how they can effectively use communities. And the question at the end that people were most grappling with is, how do we measure success? And, you know, when you consider a company such as that, one of the main ways or reasons that people even get involved or feel motivated to get involved as a community participant for such a company is because of the pain they experience with the product or the service, and either solving that pain for others or solving it for themselves. And in that pain-solving process, the company learns so much about how to make their products better. That goes straight to the bottom line, you know, and as far as selling, you sell more of better products. And the measurable thing that goes along with that, in addition to sales, is how much influence you are able to accrue, not just as a software manufacturer, but as somebody who's reaching out to the community and listening and responding and getting people within the community to talk about the product positively, to point into the community for resources that will help others. And, you know, that kind of thing is fairly easy to track and monitor and watch on the web. You can also watch the negative skew of that as well and address that too.
I think the challenge, though, and I've heard a couple of other people this morning that we talked to talk about this, is that there isn't yet, while it is conceptually easier to measure the things that you talked about, there isn't yet a long track record of having done that. There aren't studies that show typically, you know, a loss of a reduction in defections of X or an increase in sales of Y. The data isn't out there yet, or at least most people haven't seen it. So it seems that we're sort of in a temporary, hopefully temporary stage where the benefits aren't yet well quantified. They're quantifiable, but that takes some time and some experience, and they haven't yet been quantified. And actually, I guess I should turn that into a question. Do you know? I don't. Do you know of examples, either of you, where the benefits of this, where an ROI has actually been calculated, or is it a little too soon to see that?
I'm a lawyer rather than a business person, so I can give you anecdotes about measures of success, although not necessarily in terms of traditional
financial
accounting measures or financial measures. Companies actually being built and sold out of user-created content, which have complexities and contradictions in terms of the legality of it all. But take YouTube as an example, which was sold an incredibly profitable transaction. It's a company that was built entirely out of a community of user-created content.
And what was YouTube order of magnitude sold for recently? It was
$65 million.
Right.
Or was B?
I think that's with the B.
Billion dollars.
Yeah. So that's a pretty dramatic example of how to monetize a community. although actually calculating the return over the initial investment is trickier. Right. There are contexts where the community content is consciously displacing traditional marketing. So, for example, Amazon.com, where all of the customer reviews of the books on the site and other products are the site, are specifically there to take the place of conventional marketing that the company otherwise does not undertake. So there's a way, I assume, within Amazon.com
to measure that,
although it's a non-traditional form of metric, as I would understand it.
Right. What are some of the examples of, before we get to the challenges like measurement and so forth, what are some examples of companies that, even if, whether they're measuring it or not, that are really deriving value from it? Whether we can put a financial number on it or not. Amazon is one example. YouTube is an obvious example. What are some companies that aren't perhaps so closely tied to communities? Well, if I can call it more mainstream companies, as they've sort of started to experiment with building communities and so forth. What are some stories or examples that you've heard of where companies have said, hey, this is working? What are they doing?
The big scale examples would include a company like IBM, which has really embraced open source software development and really shifted the whole paradigm of that company to a more service-oriented model as opposed to the classic product development model. So they're really relying on open source development communities to supply a lot of the product, and then IBM comes in at the back end in order to support and service those customers. And I think that's an incredibly important example of a mainstream, old-line, large-size company that has really embraced a form of the community model. Something that Denise and I have been talking about recently is Procter & Gamble, which has very deliberately and aggressively gone into what I would call an innovation network or innovation community mode, where they very consciously restructured their entire R&D or organization and operation around leveraging distributed assets, distributed internationally, people doing research and development in technologies and product spaces that would complement P&G's historic strengths, and then structuring a way to bring that information into the company for the benefit of their existing product lines.
Right, and I think Intuit is another excellent example that we just heard a whole lot about here at the conference.
Yeah, I've used their forms as well to solve. My experience with them is more in the customer service side, where I've had some problems with the software, and the forms were able to the customer forms were able to solve it immediately.
Mm-hmm. Microsoft is another pretty good example, and it's not one that comes to mind, terribly readily. If you're just a everyday user of Microsoft products, you're probably more involved in the pain process than in the solution process. But, Microsoft, it was one of the first companies to really have a very liberal policy about dropping the barriers to their internal development and product people, talking to the outside world and getting feedback to improve things and being able to respond directly to both developers and customers. And, I think they have thousands of bloggers within Microsoft sort of blogging on behalf of the company. That's a great way to foster community as well.
While we're on that topic, if you are a company that eventually has thousands of bloggers, how do you know that they're all? It's actually hard to imagine that every single one of them is blogging on behalf of the company. Mm-hmm. In other words, some of them may be critical of the company. I mean, if you have that scale, and again, I don't know personally about Microsoft, but is that presumably, as we turn our attention maybe to some of the challenges or issues that companies face, let's start with that one. How do you think about that as a big company when you open those gates from a policy point of view? What happens when, does it happen? Do the employees start to speak with a more balanced tone as opposed to just a positive tone about a company?
I think, as a company, when you decide to adopt that kind of strategy, there are a number of steps you have to go through to get to that point. You have to philosophically believe that this strategy is going to benefit you with, all the warts and problems that it can bring along with it. And if you have that belief, I think it's a fairly straightforward matter to give your people guidelines that they can follow. And I think, again, those guidelines can't be terribly draconian, or your strategy just isn't going to be effective. You have to give them some basic communicating with the outside world kind of guidelines that people have always had, you know, before our era of ubiquitous online communications. You know, if you're going to talk to the press or talk to someone in PR or marketing that's going to be a message to the outside world, you're going to have some parameters that you have to stay within. There's intellectual property of the company that needs to be protected to some extent. There's things that you don't want to do to subject the company to liability, such as libeling your competitors. But beyond that, you know, if you open the door and let your people speak once they know what those guidelines are, I think you can have an incredible amount of success.
Yeah, and I think the company needs to think about why it is it would encourage this activity in its on behalf of its employees. Is this really a supplement to traditional marketing and communications, or is this, in addition, a way to genuinely encourage the customer base or partners to feed information back into the company from a non-traditional point of view? You need to think about who exactly is authorized to do this within the company. You need to think about guidelines and how those guidelines are going to be enforced, who is going to be doing supervising, is there going to be supervising. You have to think about what the risks of intellectual property violations or privacy violations or defamation questions, how those risks get processed. You need to think about authenticity of voice, because the audience constituency is very sensitive to sort of strategized community building as opposed to authentic community building.
And they can tell instantly, it seems.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'll give you a quick example. Robert Scoble, who is no longer at Microsoft, as I understand it, but what, you know, really built his reputation as a blogger while he was at Microsoft, I think really had a lot of credibility in the blogosphere precisely because Microsoft gave him a degree of independence while he was at the company. And so he could – I think he actually – my sense is built a fair amount of goodwill on behalf of Microsoft precisely because he was acting, as I say, semi-autonomously.
Right, and one of the things, Mike mentioned risk management, one of the things I posit about this kind of a strategy where you sort of open up the gates to your people talking in a public way about their jobs and the problems and the projects they are working on is that it's actually, if you think about it, less risky for people to engage in public discourse that everybody understands is public because they know the context. You know, people are not sheep and utterly dense about the context of their speech. They understand that when they're speaking in public, a certain amount of restraint may be in order, a certain tone may be in order that perhaps they wouldn't use in their private communications. And when you think about all the other ways that employees have to communicate privately, and you think about all the, you know, humorous anecdotes about emails that get out or the less humorous anecdotes about emails that are smoking guns and litigation, you know, those kinds of communications, I think, can be inherently much more risky because people, and just simply talking on the telephone, you know, I mean, how long have we had that communication vehicle available to us? And in those contexts, I think people expect a good deal more privacy and speak in a different way than they do when they know they're speaking publicly.
Do you think we'll ever, last question on this specific topic, do you think we'll ever get to a point where companies who don't open up to blogs and community communication are viewed negatively and there's an assumption that they have something to hide? In other words, it becomes so typical, which I don't think we're there yet.
No.
Do you think we're headed there? Or?
Yes, I think we're headed there.
I think we're headed to a sensibility where the market perceives companies differently depending on their marketing communication strategy. So I think that there will always be a segment of the market that is perfectly respectful and accepting of a more traditionally minded company. But I think that there will be a market embrace of companies that have a more 21st century
right.
Web 2.0 sensibility as well.
All right. Let's close off this discussion by asking if there are any other challenges other than this one. We've just talked about the challenge of setting policies and opening yourself up to communication. What are a couple of the other challenges that companies typically face as they embark or they begin to embrace or experiment with working with communities?
Well, intellectual property issues are, I think, in the foreground of a lot of this activity in at least two senses. One is companies are sensitive to putting their own intellectual property interests at risk. Giving away trade secrets, diluting brands, encouraging or allowing confusion in the marketplace in a classic trademark sense, jeopardizing patent interests, and the like. And then on the flip side, of course, is if you are inviting consumers or end users of your products into the company as part of a research strategy or a product development strategy or the like, you inevitably have sort of collaboration in an extended sense on new product, new work, new content. And that raises questions of ownership and making sure that if you are a company that's relying on these communities, you want to make sure that you have the rights that you need. And you're not going to be subjected to risk down the road of some community contributor who says, I was a joint inventor or a joint author of something.
Right. And flowing from that, you know, the instinct, I think, for companies, and certainly the instinct for their legal departments, is going to be to try and maintain as much control over those intellectual property considerations as possible. And I think you really need to think strategically about that. And about how you are incenting your community to participate and the competitive forces that you are facing in doing that. Because if you know you adopt policies that require your community to fork over everything that it is that they are contributing in a very draconian way, and you don't give them back enough of an incentive to participate, whether you know they have some stake in the end result, whether the end result then becomes something that is more freely licensed and usable than it otherwise would be, you know, I think you're going to have problems with the community at large, not just the community you're trying to foster, but the entire online community that's going to come in and look at your terms and conditions and decide that you're just not playing by the right rules.
Right. Well, in fact, this is a great transition to the second part of our discussion, if you have a few more minutes, around the We Are Smarter project. Just a very brief introduction. We Are Smarter Than Me is a title of a book project. It's a book that we are trying to have written by a community. WeAreSmarter.com. You can go there and check it out. And we have struggled with this issue very significantly, and I think though, and here I'll become maybe more of a participant in the discussion as well, there really are two sides to this issue, and not that one is right and one is wrong, but there were significant economic costs of setting up this book project. There was a publisher, Pearson, the largest book publisher in the world, who has costs and financial commitments to publish a book. And while they're in this project to learn, they're not unaware of the financial implications. And we have a community who, in this project, was intended to contribute all of the content. And it took 8 or 9 months of back and forth to try to find that balance. And so I guess I'm sympathetic to both sides. We had long discussions about why would anyone in the community want to contribute, and we had also long discussions among the folks with the deep pockets saying our pockets, I mean, we'd like to learn more about this, but it means writing bigger checks, and we're already writing big checks. And where we ended up was somewhere in the middle, which was, you know, which was the business side of the equation bearing some of the costs, but having the right to some of the benefits. But I guess the real insight there, I mean, there's obviously not going to be a right answer for any individual case, but I think the real point that we learned there was it was incredibly hard to find that, incredibly hard and very messy to find that middle ground. We had no one to follow. We didn't know who to turn to. There was no model to pick, and we just literally stumbled for 9 months arguing back and forth, debating more accurately.
Did you engage your community in this discussion and get some temperature read on what it was that they thought they should be getting out of their participation?
You know, it's a great question. No, we didn't, and that was a big mistake. We engaged the community on every other design dimension. The software platform, the role of the moderators, and we didn't engage them on this. And we should have. It was a big mistake.
Although as an academic, I could possibly predict some of the difficulties you might have had in getting genuine feedback. That is, you know, so every community setting is, by definition, extremely context sensitive. And the academic setting is no exception. So my initial read would be, well, break this down between folks who have tenure and folks who don't, because the incentive structures are going to be very different for those two populations of people. Think also in terms of, on both sides, think about the non-monetized reward system that generally exists in terms of academia and how awkwardly that now sits relative to emerging forms of collaboration, technology-enabled and otherwise, and there's just not a good collective setting understanding in academia generally about how those two systems coexist. So I think in interrogating the community is a really important thing to do, but it's also, in some contexts, really hard to get good answers, even if you know the right questions to ask.
Well, and in fact, in this case, the community was the academic community of writers plus the non-academic community mm-hmm. of writers. We didn't restrict it to one or the other. And so you have not just tenured, non-tenured, but you also have non-academic.
So your reward structures are even more complicated than that.
Right.
Why don't you describe the middle ground that you arrived at?
Well, the middle ground we arrived at was that the authors of the book will have the right to direct royalties to charity. So if you contribute a comma, although there may be something in the text which says you have to actually write a few words, but if you are a contributor to the text, you get one vote along with each other contributor to direct the royalties to charity. Now, in that particular case, the authors, the technical authors of the project, myself and Barry Liebert, were not interested in getting the royalties. Also, because I don't think the royalties are going to, you know, be so unimaginably large that it would make a difference. But so we basically gave the community, in effect, all of the upside, knowing that there wouldn't be that much upside, and notionally it seemed that was the right thing to do. But we also gave the community the right to all the public content, along with the publisher and the authors. But we gave the authors and the publisher also the right to use the content in other published forms and formats, including, for example, this conference, mm-hmm. where the individual authors didn't have that right. So we divided up the financial rewards and we divided up the use of the content. We let everyone have a piece of something, basically. And you know that this actually wasn't the primary obstacle. But it just followed on very precisely from the discussion we were having about law and intellectual property and so forth. The primary obstacle was and remains the amount, the number, the size of the community that's necessary, which is very large, to generate the intellectual input for a book. We have 3,500 people that have joined the community. I saw one of the speakers this morning talked about the 1% rule in Wikipedia. That's about what our rule is. It's 1 or 2%. But that's not enough. It turns out that 60 people as a community can't write a book. You probably need 500 or 750, which means we need, you know, 75,000 to come in and be part of the community so that we can get the 750 to write it. No one knew that. Right. In fact, we still don't know it technically because we don't have that many contributors. So it raises actually another question. If you're a company, how many people do you need to do product development? How many people do you need to do customer service? I think you'd probably need fewer to do some of those things than you do to write a book. But nobody really knows, and the different roles are going to. There's going to be some metrics that evolve over time that we don't know yet. And again, I'm sort of speculating because we haven't reached that level. At one level, you can say it's very satisfying. We've got 3,500 people. Many, many more have come to the site, and we know that there's usually sort of a 10-to-1 ratio of people who haven't registered. So there's probably 30,000 people who are on there at one point in time looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
But that leads 3,000 to register and 30 or 60 or 90 to contribute.
I think this comes back to the point we were talking about earlier about the community as your evangelists, because once you have so motivated your community that they are not only participating in the community, they are telling the rest of the world how great this project is in totally different contexts, then your numbers problem rapidly begins to be solved.
Right.
Some of this, I think, also depends on the scale of the project that you're undertaking, right? So the scale and depth of the community that you want to build is going to be related to whether you're undertaking a mass market project or a niche project or something in between, right? So a smaller number of incredibly devoted people can sustain a much narrower project, whereas an undertaking that has a much broader focus is going to need a proportionately broader base. Even if the 1% rule continues to hold.
It also seems that starting something fresh versus adding on to something that exists is also a factor. In Intuit's case, or any of the companies that you all mentioned, there's a business, and it's running, and it does product development, it does innovation, it does customer service, and then it adds on to that a community approach, and that either works or it doesn't. In the cases you described, it worked. In our case, there wasn't a book already being written, to which one would add on a community. The community either wrote the book or the book didn't really exist. And so there's sort of a kind of a chicken and egg startup problem that a new project has to overcome, that maybe existing companies can afford a more incremental approach. I'm just hypothesizing.
Right. But then YouTube had the chicken and egg problem, too, and it did just fine.
Exactly. So, I mean, so obviously there's something about the YouTube was a better idea than We Are Smarter Than Me. I mean, you know.
Right. It works in multiple directions, right? So building a community around an existing product or service has one set of complications. Strategically, for example, do you want to limit community to participation to people who are already tangibly invested in the existing business, or do you want to decouple those two things to some degree? If you are able, as in the YouTube context, to build an enterprise around user-created content, how do you leverage that, as YouTube ultimately did by selling out to Google? In Pittsburgh, where I live, I'm involved in the early stages of a community development project that began online amongst a handful of bloggers in Pittsburgh who blog about Pittsburgh and the future of Pittsburgh, and we're now organizing in real space to leverage our little virtual enterprise into something more tangible. The arrows point in multiple directions.
Right, absolutely. I wish we could keep talking about this, because I think that this is a subject where we're just beginning to frame the dialogue, and I think this discussion has started to do that. But in the interest of time, I'm going to draw it to a close and hope that we can continue in some fashion going forward. We've been talking to Denise Howell, logger, blogger, and podcaster, who has coined the term blog. BLAWG. Is that right?
Yes, I'll go to my grave with that one.
And Mike Madison, who's a professor at the University of Pittsburgh. Denise and Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.